Let's go to Shifra Hoffman now at from Shuva.net and victimsofarabterror.com. Welcome to the show, Shifra Hoffman.
Hi, Tamar, and to all the listeners and the many listeners. I'm getting not very good feedback, thank God.
Nice to hear.
Okay, I just want to say before we begin with the topics, you know, everything that we want to know can be found in the Tanakh or in the Psalms. King David understood the enemy very well, and he wrote, "Why are the nations in an uproar? And why do the peoples mutter in vain? The kings of the earth stand up, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed." So he understood that all the anti-Semites, they're not really fighting Jews. They're fighting Lahavzel, the God of Israel. And the God of Israel is ready for them. So they better wake up fast. Anyway, I would like to, because of this sacred time of Yom HaZikaron, the memorial for the soldiers, so many of the beautiful soldiers, the martyred soldiers that we lost in every war. And by the way, I think it's very important to remember that Israel did not start the wars. Israel extended a hand to the Arabs when we came back as our reborn state, our reborn country, with God's help in 1948. And, of course, the Arabs cut off the hand. So I believe, though, that every year when they show on television, and it's really heartrending, the families, the broken families, the mothers, the fathers, the children, the orphans, every one of them. And they show all of these soldiers that were killed, but they don't show the heroism. They don't show the battles that they won. They don't show the victories that God gave us. And that's, I think, sending a very negative message, both to our youth and also to the enemy who enjoys it. When they see soldiers in their graves, they rejoice. So I'm hoping that, you know, I wrote the letters to the Jerusalem Post and some other media, hoping that they understand that they should show what General Patton said, that the object of war is not to die for one's country, but to have the enemy die for his.
I think he said it in a little bit less tactful words.
Less delicate, yes. But he was a great general, and he understood that when you fight, you have to fight for your rights and not for the enemy's rights, which it seems, you know, it's going downhill here. All the time they try to balance it with what will the world say and whether the Arabs will like it. First of all, if we want to really do an analysis, and there's really not time for it now, but I'm trying to write my book, and God willing, I hope it'll be included. Everything that started was not started by the Arabs. It was started by the bleeding heart liberals who felt, oh, the Arabs want the same things we do. No, they don't. They don't want Israel. They don't want Jerusalem. They don't want us here. The Arabs want what Islam teaches. So let's get that straight from the get-go.
All right. And you wanted to talk about the fact if Israel is really independent, or what some people like to joke about, because a little bit of truth in every joke, that Israel is maybe the 51st state of the United States.
You know, the dictionary describes independence like this: politically self-governing, free from control of others, not committed to a political party or faction, not relying on others, especially for financial support. Now, if we were truly independent and we understood that the miracle of coming back after 2,000 years to Eretz Israel had nothing to do with the nation, yes, the nation voted for it, but that was part of God's plan, that after 2,000 years, Jews coming from every corner of the earth certainly is miraculous, and certainly you have to understand that as the Tanakh teaches, our Bible teaches, that God promised to bring us back, and he promised to establish our state here, but also if we will obey his laws. And what is happening today is not political, it's the religious war. I've said this ad infinitum. It's a war between Islam and all the Western world and our world, because unfortunately, the Arabs, I mean, we may laugh at 72 virgins, but they believe in it. And the Havdol Elav Havdolot, we were given the Torah, the truth. And so many of our people, unfortunately, either do not obey the laws or they laugh at them and think it's antiquated. So we have to understand, what does Israel independence really mean? A couple of years ago, I wrote an article called Israel Dependence Day, because it seems that Israel is dependent on what America will say. Each time a president is elected, the question is asked, is he good for the Jews? Why should a president of a country, not Israel, be good for the Jews? We want the president of Israel to be good for the Jews. And there might be some argument here also with our president. But putting that aside, independence means exactly that. It means that we have the right to build, to settle, to do everything that we should do in our sovereign country. And as long as we don't do that, I'm afraid that we're going to lose more wars. And I really feel, I must quote the late and great Rabbi Meir Kahan's blessed memory, who understood so well what we are facing. He said, one Israeli soldier is worth all the enemies of the world.
Let me ask you a question, Shifra. If you were given the power to be the Prime Minister of Israel and you didn't have to go through a cabinet or Knesset votes and you can have your policies put through, how would you run things?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing sometimes in the Internet and also mail. I get mail saying that, why don't you run for Prime Minister or for the Knesset? I tell them I run from the Knesset. But the truth is I'm much more free to speak out and to do whatever I think as a non-aligned, so to speak. But to answer your question, we, the Jewish people, are part of a historic plan. We are the chosen people. I remember one year in California when I was on the radio program, and I said that we are the chosen people. Some fellow called up, and the moderator said he almost racked up his car. He was hysterical. How dare you say that? It's racist. We're not better than anyone. It doesn't mean that we're better than anyone. It means we were chosen to be a light unto the nations, although the nations of the world have spared no effort to extinguish that light. But if I were, you know, in the power to run things with God's help, of course, I would do what the Torah tells us to do, and that is that we have to understand what this country means. It's not just another country. It's the home for the Jewish people. Jewish rights come first. Why should so many Jews suffer here? You know, I'm the head of the Victims of Arab Terror International, and tomorrow, I cannot tell you, it takes every grit of me to be able to face these people who suffer so terribly, having lost their loved ones. In many cases, the murderers were freed. Most of them don't get enough to go by. You know, we have to help them financially. So I would, the first thing I would do was establish Jewish rights for Jews. That means no apology. Everywhere a Jew wants to settle, he has the right to settle in that one country. And that all the monies that are raised have to go for the welfare of the Jewish people and not for Gaza and not for, you know, because some good shalom moron, I'm sorry, thinks that we're doing terrible things to the Arabs. The Arabs have 22 sovereign countries. They have billions of oil dollars. They can very well absorb all their refugees in their countries the way we, Israel, with one tiny country the size of New Jersey and no oil dollars, absorbed with God's help our refugees from the Holocaust, from Ethiopia, from the former Soviet Union, and the refugees from all the Arab countries, which the world doesn't seem to notice or care. So another thing that I would do is I would strike from the lexicon world opinion. I don't care about what the world says. The world was very silent when we were going up in smoke, 6 million Jews. So that's what I would do for starters.
Let me ask you a question. I'm going to play devil's advocate here because I would like you to be able to empower the Prime Minister with some good ideas because he's facing an awful lot of pressure. I'm not defending him. I'm simply stating a fact. And I'm not saying I agree with you. I don't agree with you. I'm just going to play devil's advocate for a learning exercise here. So you're the Prime Minister of Israel, and you've got pressure from the United States, and they're telling you, perhaps, this is just a hypothetical situation, we're not going to sell you parts of your airplanes into your tanks. We're not going to we're not going to send you any ammunition weapons. We will tell all of our citizens that you're a pariah, you're on the list of nations of not to tour because we deem you as a hostile nation because you're not listening, you're not working for peace. And then you've got people in your own country who are left-wing or who are centrists who really think that Israel needs America in order to survive. We need a friend in the world, and America is believed to be our friend, and we need that. And they're going to say, you know what, if you're going to cut us off from the world and make us alone, and all of our contracts that we have with businesses of selling things and visiting, I've got appointments and meetings in different countries, and they're all considering us like a pariah state now, and they're putting us on their X list of going to visit. Nobody can have dealings with us, maybe even making it illegal. We are going to lose our businesses, and we are going to now shut down the country. We know how the Histadrut, which is the labor union here, works in Israel. They shut down the airports. They shut down the hospitals. Doctors go on strike. They can shut down public transportation. They can put this country at a standstill. What would you do?
Well, first of all, let's look at history. You know, there were times when the United States did not give weapons to Israel, And we survived with tremendous miracles. I think it was only Nixon, and he was no Jew lover, but he did send weapons. But even Harry Truman, historically, if we look up the facts, was not so anxious to give weapons. And I think he really did not give weapons when we were facing, an army of so many Arabs. Look, this is a test. Life is a test that we have to pass personally and collectively, just like our father Abraham. And the more we try to appease them, the more they're going to do exactly what you said, because they see they can pressure us. Their motivation is Arab oil, not Jewish blood. And we, the people that came back with God's help to America, from Israel, there was an Israel long before there was an America, and there'll be an Israel, God willing, long after. So we have to stand our ground and to say, look, if you are indeed an ally and not all lies, as I have written many times, you will understand our situation. If not, we will do what we have to do for our own survival, and as God has helped us always, he will help us again.
Shifra Hoffman, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you for strengthening us with your words, and I wish you a very special and sincere day of a Memorial Day that we should appreciate what we have and appreciate all the sacrifices others have made for us. And afterwards, have a wonderful Yom HaTzmaut.
You too, Tamar. And may I just tell the people, please, if you'd like to get in touch with us and help the victims of Arab terror, which is a great, great mitzvah, please call us at 02-5821-106 or look at our website, victimsofarabterror.com.
All right. Thank you for being with us, Shifra Hoffman. All right. In another minute, we're going to have to take a break. We're going to be talking about the Chorva Synagogue when we get back. The Chorva Synagogue is a very ancient synagogue in the Old City, not just footsteps from the Kotel, from the Western Wall, and from Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount. And there is a... Why don't I just read you what they say about this? According to some, the Vilna Gaon was to have made the connection that Geula, the redemption, is just around the corner. He says that when the third Chorva, meaning like the third time that the Chorva would be rebuilt or built up, at the third time, it would be a sign that the third Beit HaMikdash, the third Holy Temple, also would soon be rebuilt and reactivated. Is it true? What are we going to see now happening? What is happening now? Actually, there were riots when Israel, the government went in and had the Chorva Synagogue renovated because it was in ruins, and it is now functioning as a synagogue once again for the third time. Is redemption just around the corner? That's the question. We're going to be speaking with Rachel Silber, who herself is from the Old City and is able to walk to the Chorva Synagogue from her home on the Sabbath. And she's going to tell us some interesting stories that went on there. The Chorva Synagogue, a very, very famous historical synagogue in the Old City, has been renovated recently by the Israeli government. And as I read to you in the previous hour, according to some, the Vilna Gaon was to have made this connection, saying that the redemption is just around the corner, that when the Chorva would be rebuilt for its third time, it would be a sign that the third Beit HaMikdash also would soon be rebuilt and reactivated. So we have joining us now, Rachel Silber. She wrote a very interesting article on her website called kolrina.org, kolrina. And the article that she wrote is called Not Just Another Geula Rumor. And I want to welcome to the show, Rachel, to tell us more about this. Welcome to the show, Rachel Silber.
The fact is, the interesting thing about the Chorva Shul, and just a little bit more of history, is that it was actually called Chorva during the time of its glory. It was called the Chorva Shul of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, even when it was magnificently beautiful and built. So the Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank said that somehow that shul, now he said this also about 100 years ago, the fact that it was called the Chorva, even at the time of its glory, connected it to the Beis HaMikdash. So that's all that we had in terms of information that was chronicled and that was really based in fact. The fact that the Vilna Gaon predicted that somehow its rebuilding would be a geula would somehow connect to the Beis HaMikdash, the Geula of the Beis, and the rebuilding of the third Beis HaMikdash.
And by the way, I haven't seen that in the Sefer, really. I just want to jump again. Geula, for people who don't know Hebrew, it means redemption. If you use a Hebrew word, try if you can, just to follow it with an English word.
Right, okay. And so, but understanding that at the time of the Gaon of Vilna, in the end of the 1700s, the second building of the shul was just commencing. And so he predicted, supposedly, that it would be built a second time, destroyed a second time, and then rebuilt a third time. When it was indeed destroyed in 1948 by the Jordanians, it was left a pile of rubble. And we came back, B'chazei Hashem, thank God, with God's kindness and love, we came back to the land of Israel, to Jerusalem in 1967, finding basically the entire old city, not just the Churva Shul, but the entire old city, the entire, all of the homes that had been Jewish, anything that was Jewish was completely destroyed and rubble. And so the Israeli government began to rebuild the structures, and as we see today, we have a beautiful, beautiful old city. But for some reason, they didn't complete the building of the Churva Shul. They had it on the plans, and for some reason, the agency, the construction agency, didn't complete it. They made the floor, they made the arch, but somehow it was never completed. And it was not necessarily, there were no plans to make it into the beautiful structure that it is now. They were just going to refurbish a shul, which for some reason they didn't do. Now we, who consider this connected to indeed, redemption and the rebuilding of the third temple, can understand now why in 1967 they didn't, because perhaps it wasn't the time. Anyway, that was the rumor that was going around, that when they would rebuild the Churva Shul, the synagogue, the Rabbi Yehuda Chassid synagogue for the third time, it was somehow connected to the building of the third Beit HaMikdash. And there were people who actually, I know people who actually, changed travel plans to be at the commemorative ceremony, at the opening ceremony of the Shul. They were supposed to go to leave the country for whatever reasons, and they decided to push it off, hoping that that rumor would indeed materialize and that the Beis HaMikdash would somehow, the temple, the third temple, would somehow manifest. Anyway, that was the date of the opening of the shul of the synagogue and the old city was set to be the first day of the holy month of Nisan, the month of redemption, the month of the holiday of Passover, and the month where we have a tradition in the Talmud that says that we will be redeemed. And so the first day of Passover was the opening of the synagogue, and it was a very, very beautiful opening. It was a very festive. There was a ceremony bringing a Torah scroll from the Kotel and putting her into the ark of the shul. But basically, no temple descended. And, it was a little bit of a disappointment for people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the first part of this ends.
Okay.
At that point, after the ceremonies were over, the first Shabbat, the first Shabbos that, they had services, friends of mine who live in the old city decided to attend the shul. Now this shul, the Churva Synagogue, was the actual community shul of the entire old city. And it unified the entire old city. Everyone in the 1700s when it began to be constructed, and then from the middle of the 1800s until 1948, that was the community shul of the old city. Everyone went to that shul.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very unifying structure. And
a shul is a synagogue,
shul,
by the way.
A unifying synagogue. Everyone went there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first Shabbat that they had services, the people of the old city went to the shul, to the services, and it wasn't a political thing anymore. It wasn't a commemorative or ceremonial. It was just a regular shul that was opening. And so friends of mine went to that service and said the following. Now, these are people who are living in Israel for many, many years, and all of us who live here know that with the wonderful air and the great water and the fantastic food that we have here and the holiness is just all around us, there's also a certain amount of cynicism or practicality perhaps that we develop. And so my friends who went wanted to see who was going to, how the shul would be run and how the service would be held. And they were so, so happy because when they came to the shul, the services were led. Whoever decided, whoever was the gabbai, whoever was in charge of dividing up the honors at the first Shabbos did a very good job because every single community in the Jewish nation was represented. Someone from one community was the chazan led the prayers for Shacharis, and someone from a totally different community led the afternoon prayers, and someone from a third different community said a few different words. But really, by the Torah reading, which is really where people's honors are at stake a little bit, they excelled because they gave an aliyah to the Torah, which means that they called a person to the Torah and he made a blessing on the portion that they were reading, and we do that 7 or 8 times during the services. They made sure to give one aliyah to every different community that existed and exists in the old city. They gave to Atera Kohanim, who are the yeshiva that is dedicated to rebuilding the third Beit HaMikdash. They gave an aliyah to the Zilbermans, who are the Vilna Gaon, the descendants of the Vilna Gaon, who were the first people who reconstructed this Beit HaMikdash. They gave to Chabad of the old city. They gave to these religious Zionists, they gave one aliyah to the religious Zionist group. They gave an aliyah to the Hasidic group in the old city. They gave an aliyah to the regular man on the street. Everyone got an aliyah to the Torah. Everyone was called to the Torah and was given the honor of participating. So
that's a great goodbye that they had at that station.
What?
That's a great goodbye that they had at the synagogue there.
That's right.
That he did that Ahava Israel.
That's
not
right.
Making it just, you know, we are this type of synagogue now. Rather, we are all of Am Yisrael, the nation of Israel together, and we want to bring on the Geula, the
That's
redemption,
right.
as you said.
That's
Can you tell
exactly
us a bit
right.
about your website before you go?
My Kol website. Nina? Well, can I just finish this one thought?
Yes, absolutely.
So really what I thought was that we thought that the third Beit HaMikdash would come down on the day that this shul was opened, and indeed perhaps part of it did, because the third Beit HaMikdash is going to have to be an edifice, a place where everyone's going to feel comfortable. Everyone will feel that this is their place, their opening, their shul, their connection to God, and that's exactly what they were able to accomplish at the Churba's reopening. So I think it was a fantastic, I really think that it did happen on a certain level, on a macrocosmic level. Something did happen in that opening of the shul. And that's how really the redemption is happening. It's happening very slowly and in natural ways and in ways that might appear to be perhaps natural. But really, if you look a little bit deeper, you see that every single event that's happening in our nation and really in the world is just one, the step, the clock is ticking closer and closer to the time where God will openly reveal himself and that everyone will see mm-hmm. exactly the hand of Hashem and everything.
Right. I mean, God bless the Jewish people.
God bless us all.
Thank you so much for being with us. And really, just keep us inspired with your website, kolrina.org. I'm going to put a link for that on our website as well. Thank you so much for being
okay.
with us.
And you too, Tamar. Thank you for all the great work that you go.
Thank
that
you.
Do.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Kol too.
All right. So some good news and a nice story to hear, and may we merit the redemption very soon. And talking about good things happening, we have another Jew who is today in Israel, and he's working here, volunteering. He's with me right now in the studio. His name is Derek Kling, and he's here on a program where he's doing voluntary work. And I want to welcome you to the show. Hi there, Derek.
Hello. How are you?
Oh, wait a second. I have to get this up. Try it again.
Yes, hello.
There we go. Okay. So, Derek, tell us about, very briefly, where you're from in the United States and why you decided to come here and what program you're on and how it's inspired you and how you've inspired others.
I'm from Canada, Montreal.
Ah, okay.
And I am on a 10-month program called Otsma. It's geared towards post-college graduates, and pretty much it's divided into 3 parts. The first 3 months we're here, we study in Ulpan, learning Hebrew, getting adjusted to the culture, doing community work. The next 3 months we're sent to different developing towns where we do volunteer work of all different kinds. And then the last 3 months we get to do either an internship or stay on a kibbutz. And really, the reason I chose to come on the program was after I graduated college, I wanted to break from school. And ever since I came here to Israel on birthright in summer 2007, I really had a thirst to come back to Israel and really reconnect with my roots. And, I wanted something more something more than that 10-day sort of taste that I got. I really wanted to experience the country, the culture, and really really see what it's like to, you know, live in as an Israeli here.
So what made you choose an internship over going and spending time in a kibbutz, which is so romantic, you know, thinking of like really getting down to the roots of agriculture in the land of Israel?
Well, I found that for me, my personality, I kind of would feel a little too constrained on a kibbutz. It's for some people it's great, but for me, I wanted something where I could really, you know, have more freedom to travel around the country and continue to experience really the entire culture and the country of Israel, and really, you know, sort of have my own schedule. That's pretty much why I chose the internship.
So you're interning here at IsraelNationalNews.com.
Yes.
And what do you do with the rest of your time while you're here?
The rest of my time, I'm learning part-time in Mayanot Yeshiva in Jerusalem. And I travel around. I have some family and some family friends here in Israel. So I spend my Shabbats in different places around the country, and I get to see all types of different settings, environments, and I'm pretty much just living the Jewish dream, as they say. All I could say is, if you're a Jew and you haven't been to Israel yet, really go on Birthright, go on any one of these programs they have, and
Birthright still free?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah, I think Birthright is still
okay,
free.
Okay, so if you're between the ages, I think it's of 18 and 28, I'm not sure, check out Birthright, Google it, and you can also Google Otzma. I'm on the website right now about programs here in Israel where they'll set you up with housing and with, you know, you'll be able to survive here. Do you have an adoptive family, did they give you?
Yeah, they give us adoptive families in different cities right now. Yeah, it's great.
All right, well, I want to thank you for being on the show, Derek, and good
thank
luck
you.
Here, and we hope that you make Aliyah as well and join us, join your brothers and sisters here.